see everybody again.
I have been asked to say a couple of words about what I'll be doing in that workshop. It's very, very interesting, and it's an extension of how we have evolved for the last 60,000 years or so, right, since we've been Homo sapiens sapiens. We keep augmenting ourselves. I'm seeing a lot of augmented humans around here. You've got a hearing aid, you've got a heart, what do you call it, a little stimulator in there? Pacemaker, thank you. And lots of others. The work is becoming almost like a miracle as far as injured vets that come back from wars, in the Gulf Wars. And it used to be, well, you lost an arm, sorry about that, but now they can actually give prosthetic arms that are workable. Even more remarkable is brain injury. They can go ahead and literally hook the brain up to a computer. And we're going to, this is therapeutic stuff, right? We're going to talk about when these kind of augmentations become, for better and for worse, consumer goods, right? Say you're getting a little fuzzy, memory's a little bit fuzzy, we got this thing that you can get installed in your head, or these special pills that you can take. By the way, it's already a big con industry. Some of the movies that have come out recently, Lucy is one that is some kind of medication, and then Limitless. It's got everybody wanting them clear plastic looking pills, and they've got them for you. Only $50 a bottle. See, they're going to make you smart, and you're thinking, this didn't do squat. See, you're smarter already. It's a kind. We'll look at the various aspects of human enhancement, human augmentation. We'll also look at the social and the ethical aspects of it, because I said these are going to become, to a certain extent, consumer products. If you think that isn't going to reflect financial disparities in our culture, you're simply not thinking straight. So that's the kind of stuff that we'll look at. Okay. I'm glad to see you all. We talked about Jonathan Haidt last time. Let me bring him back into the conversation just for a minute to get us kicked off. His book, The Righteous Mind, was published in 2012. In 2010, he published a short essay in the Chronicle of Higher Education titled Fast Evolution. And what his hypothesis in that short thing, just as sort of a notice, evolution didn't stop way back when. And this is, again, so much about evolutionary theory has changed radically since I was an undergraduate. I mean, it's already done. We're here. We've arrived, and now we just do everything by culture. No, biological evolution is continuing right down into the 21st century, not just continuing, but accelerating. And the point that he makes, if you want to get a sense of the extent to which that is so, take a look at the parallels in human and dog evolution. Our evolution has changed us behaviorally. Our evolution has changed us genetically, quite literally. We tend to think that if you go back 40,000 years, and many people have said this, so the thought experiment, take a newborn infant, with the parent's permission, of course, take a newborn infant and swap it out with a Cro-Magnon. Get your time machine, swap it out with a Cro-Magnon kid of 40,000 years ago, and they would be raised pretty much the same. And no doubt there would be a good deal to be said for that pretty much the same, because culture plays such a huge role in us. But we are now at this point significantly genetically different. Significantly, we have different kinds of minds because we have different kinds of brains. These are hugely interesting, and that's why I'm so interested in human-dog evolution. So I'm really determined this time to leave more time at the end of the talk to have you ask questions, because that's really, really terrific. We humans, modern humans, we proudly call ourselves Homo sapiens sapiens. That means, somewhat embarrassingly oftentimes, the wise, wise humans. In fact, we have been around for 65,000 years perhaps, we are in the infancy of our species. If you stop and think that Neanderthals, we sort of helped them off stage about 30,000 years ago. Neanderthals were around for some 325,000 years. We've been around for a much shorter time. What kind of differences do we make? The Neanderthals made no big climatic changes. They didn't change the environment. And when we look at Neanderthals, here was their technology, a short stabbing spear, some cutting stones and things like that. And that's what they had when they started 325,000 years earlier. And when they finally went extinct, they were using the same stuff. So when you stop and think of the way that our technology has enhanced, clearly something is different about this species. From the start, we were a predator species, and that means that we ate meat. We ate other animals. And in practicing that carnivorous agenda, we had lots of competition, and that brings us to what I want to be specializing on this afternoon. Our most potent rival predator, once our Homo sapien ancestors, and it was around 40,000 years ago. They developed in Africa. They moved from Africa, so there were immigrants from Africa. Everybody got a problem with that? No, of course we don't. Immigrants from Africa, they tended to be called Cro-Magnons. You've probably heard that name for them. And they came, and it just wasn't fair. They had language skills. They had little things that you wouldn't notice. The Neanderthals were adversely impacted by a reassertion of the ice age, cold weather. Wait a minute, I thought these guys were adapted for cold, and they are. They've got these big noses to warm up the air as they breathe it in. They've got short, stocky bodies to maintain the heat. But what they didn't have, again, turns on technology. They didn't have a needle and thread. They couldn't sew clothes together. They had to get a big like poncho thing and put it around them, and it was not very warm, and so they suffered intensely from the weather. But again, our interest is in Canis lupus, the wolf. We call dogs Canis lupus familiaris. That's what we call dogs. But I brought in this little illustration. I'll be using it throughout the presentation. And the first thing I want to invite your attention to is it's a hell of a good book just recently published by Richard Francis, Domesticated. And he talks about how both humans and dogs went through the process of self-domestication. I'll say what I mean by that in a second. It's an irresistible. My wife wanted to get let's send to the publisher. Let's get a poster of this book cover. We need it for our wall because we have a Bichon Frise, and that's a Bichon Frise in the thing next to the big towering book. The picture is irresistible and makes the point. But don't be taken in by it. A Bichon Frise is more a product not of wolf evolution, that, yes, in a very remote way, but in 1874, kennel clubs were set up in Great Britain where they developed designer dogs for the wealthy, bored and distracted, to show their dogs that only wealthy people could afford. And that's where all these hybrid dogs came out of, and we're now learning what a disaster that is. I guess I'm saying, if you want to get a puppy dog, don't get a purebred. You're buying a bunch of genetic problems with a purebred. Get a mutt. Mutts are great. Anyhow, I've got a purebred rescue dog. There is. Also, another point is that if this were not a photoshopped picture, the wolf, you could imagine the wolf thinking to itself, oh dear, how thoughtful. I simply love French cuisine. Wolves eat dogs. Wolves eat foxes and coyotes. They're one of their favorite foods. So it's not me and my big buddy here. It's somebody get me out of this. Here's the background story. According to a consensus of scientists who studied both dog and human evolution, until recently it was thought that the dog-wolf split had occurred some 14,000 years ago. That I remember when that was the common knowledge. It's gone way back since then. For some 30,000 years, wolves and humans were mortal enemies of each other. Wolves killed us, we killed them. It was deeply hostile because we competed for the same prey, and also occasionally we killed and preyed upon each other. But about 35,000 years ago, that relationship began to change. So now the origins of the transition from wolf to dog is pushed way back 36,000, depending on who you're talking about, depending on which locality. So it's been pushed way back. And about 35,000 years ago, according to current estimations, that relationship began to change. It also used to be thought that the domestication of wolves involved brave Cro-Magnons, let's call them, right? Brave Cro-Magnon going out there and going into a wolf den, grabbing the wolf puppy or finding a wolf puppy and going and taking it back to the tribal center of the village and raising it among them. Isn't that cute? But if you've ever raised a wild animal, they are cute as a button for the first 9 or 10 months, and then they turn into wolves. And they are extremely dangerous. And the idea of having village children running around, these village children, which are the precise prey size, ideal prey size for these, it just doesn't make sense. So something other than domestication, human domestication, must have gone on. It is now considered to be not a viable hypothesis that we raise them. Again, the emerging consensus, a strong consensus among scientists, is that we didn't domesticate wolves into dogs. Wolves domesticated themselves. And that gives us a great point of commonality. I mean, there's arguments about it, but according to many people, there are two major species on this planet today that have successfully practiced self-domestication. Wolves and us, right? We are self-domesticated. Wolf self-domestication, again, is something they did by surmounting a natural tendency to flee away. Not to attack us, but to run away. It's called flight distance, and there was a flight distance barrier. It would make them flee from their heretofore deadly enemies. This began happening especially when our hunter-gatherer groups, there were no civilizations yet, civilizations didn't emerge, about 11,000 years ago, depending on who you're talking to about it. But we lived in hunter-gatherer groups. But we had campsites, and we had things that could qualify as villages. And when we started to live in villages, it wasn't very elegant way of disposing of trash, but we just threw it outside the village, right? We'd take the remains of what you didn't eat and just throw it out there because, you know, you don't want to eat it now. But this was very attractive to wolves. What happened is that these proto-dogs were no longer powerfully driven by adrenaline and its threat response agendas. That's what makes things, the panic, fight or flight response is driven by adrenaline. You couldn't go up and pet them. They weren't tame dogs, but they were different dogs. As a matter of fact, I put that on there. This picture of the on the upper right, want to go pet the nice doggy, the nice wolf. This is why people who are anthropologists and study dogs say the movie Dances with Wolves is a splendid romance, but it is absolute nonsense that this guy would buddy up and chase around with wild wolves. There'd be no way that they could have the background to do that. It took generations of wolves living in close proximity. Not every wolf could do that. Some wolves just never did, never became tame, never became dogs. When civilization emerged, some humans just didn't want to go there. It was dirty. It stunk. I'm going to live out in the pure countryside. That disposition of purity is evident in the book of Genesis, where Cain and Abel offer sacrifices to God. God accepts one and rejects the other. Which one does he accept? Meat. Meat. God like meat, right? God likes meat. God does not like produce and vegetation, because what do you have to get produce? Fields that are kept in other words, that's a sign of civilization. Civilization, when it began, for very good reasons. How do you know where the city is? Follow your nose, right? And that's why incense got to be such a big deal, to simply damp down the stench so that you could eat your dinner, for example. So cities were seen as not a good thing, and not everybody came to them. Those that did, and this is a little bit controversial, those that did were under a different kind of pressure. Self-domestication among humans, you had to learn to do things like stay off the grass and do this. You had to have a more sophisticated, more complex environment that you walk through. Not everybody could do that. They went off into the hills and became, shall we say, hillbillies, or a version of that. They became country people. And to this day, the well-educated, the more opportunities are in urban areas rather than country. And I know I'll get an argument from rural people. I grew up in the country, and what I knew as a little boy, I got to get out of town. I got to get the hell out of here and get to a city somewhere, because I just felt it. All the TV that I was watching so much back at the time called me to a city. So, again, the flight distance shortened. Wolves before, a wolf would see humans, Cro-Magnons coming along, or Neanderthals, right, and run because they're going to kill you. Gradually, they began to calm down. Not all of them, but some stayed there and ate in the garbage pits while the humans were around. Flight distance closed. All of a sudden, we're sharing the same, a lot of ground. That took a special kind of wolf. Not all wolves could do that. It also took a special kind of humans. And I'm not speaking of Neanderthals now, but it took a special kind of humans. Humans who had adapted the kind of consciousness that could consider alternative scenarios and the future implications of that. No doubt, when the first of these transitional wolves, let's call them transitional wolves, actually the formal name for them is, they are called village dogs. They're not dogs now, but they're called village dogs, but they're relatively halfway tame wolves. Again, look at that face. You don't want to go up and pet one, the one on the right, right? I mean, it's a good way to lose a finger. But what happened with this group of Homo sapiens sapiens, and I'm imagining this, is that a wolf came up and came within, say, 10 yards, and a bunch of them started reaching for their weapons. Okay, we can kill it. And one of them, maybe some, at least one, said, wait a minute, guys. Let's see where this goes. Let's just see where this goes. The wolf went around, ate a little bit closer, then wandered off. It wasn't so bad, kind of weird. And the nice thing about wolves is they sound the alarm. If somebody, they're kind of augmented sensory systems. And if you're fighting, which ancient hunter-gatherer groups did with each other before they started developing the capacity for extended out-group cooperation, the most dangerous enemy that Homo sapiens sapiens had. I mean, actually, I don't want to disparage them, but it wasn't the Neanderthals. You could get killed in an encounter with Neanderthals, but geez, they were dumb. I mean, that is to say, they did not have throwing spears. They didn't have strategies. They didn't have this kind of... Okay, I'll tell you what. Fred, you and Jim go up around there and take Bob with you, and there weren't their names, of course, and we'll come down here and see if you can get them to chase you back down, and we'll ambush them when they get here. Neanderthals could not, for all we can tell, they could not do that. So, Neanderthals, as I say, were they could not learn this trick of, wait a minute, let's see where this is going to go. Let's consider alternative scenarios here. What might happen? What if they don't happen? What good could come from that? The experiment among Homo sapiens was a resounding success. The experiment apparently simply could not be run by Neanderthals. Were they too hot-wired themselves by the adrenaline response? It's just wolf, you know, go for it, run, find, kill, either flee or kill. Were they simply incapable of doing the math required to imagine close coexistence between wolves and humans? Whatever it was a fatal flaw. And according to one recent study, marked the doom of the Neanderthals more than anything. Here come the Cro-Magnons and their damn dogs, right? That was the coup de grace, as it were. Other factors were involved, of course, but the fact that these invaders from Africa had managed to befriend a toned-down model of the wolf proved to be decisive. By the way, you don't have to be human Homo neanderthalensis or Homo sapiens sapien, right? Extraordinary things have come out, and I just wanted to briefly share them with you. There is a monkey. They look like baboons at the bottom there. They look like baboons, but they're not. They're monkeys, and you can get into a big discussion about that. They're monkeys. But they're the size of baboons. They are combative. The males fight with each other. Look at those teeth. I mean, that's a, you know, I'll tear your face off sort of thing. And they live there. Ethiopian geladas. And they live in the Ethiopian highlands in close proximity with Ethiopian wolves. And look, there they are. They live among each other. They live next to each other. The geladas will have their babies there, and there's a wolf sitting right next to them there. Everything's fine. I have actually seen, I couldn't obviously do that here, but there's film footage of a gelada picking up a wolf cub and just putting it back down. So just incredible. We humans do that all the time. Oh, what a beautiful baby. Can I hold it? Sure. But you would never do that to the big bad wolf, right? I mean, it just ain't going to happen. So this idea, and what, by the way, geladas, just without giving you more detail than you need, geladas live in larger groups than any other apes. They live in groups of three. Isn't that great? They live in groups of 3,000 to 4,000 people. A guy, an anthropologist named Robin Dunbar, has come up with Dunbar's number. In other words, the size of a group will determine the ratio of brain size to body size. He's calculated that we humans, Homo sapiens sapiens, our ideal group, how many friends are we going to have? 150, more than 150, and it just becomes people, right? That's pretty much how it is. So many of the small villages that we grew up in, hunter-gatherer groups, were 150 people. Geladas, as apes, had practiced. How are they going to stay bonded as a group? They groom each other. And so if you've got 3,000 or 4,000 other apes to groom, you are a busy monkey from dawn till dusk. So they developed other ways to do it. They developed the capacity to meaningfully vocalize grooming. So I'm grooming this one here, and okay, everything's okay, good, nice to see you, good. Words to that effect, or sounds to that effect, not words to that effect. So the idea of larger groups generate larger brains generate different different kinds of possibilities. Neanderthal groups were 12, 15, maybe 25 at max. Listen, has anybody seen Quest for Fire? It's based on a novel that was written in 1905. It is a romance. It's fun. It is absolute nonsense from the standpoint of anthropologists went nuts when it came out afterwards because it's really not, that's, it is, they were supposed to be Neanderthals, as you know, and they had vocalizations. So I want to go back now and focus on those ancestors of ours. They're, again, we call them Cro-Magnons. To repeat, they first invaded Eurasia from Africa probably between 40 and 45,000 years ago. They were emphatically hunter-gatherer bands. They were like hunter-gatherer killer bands. I mean, you see somebody, strangers, oh, look, new friends, new people. No, hunker down, everybody. We're gonna kill them. Over time, those bands learned to cooperate with each other, to trade with each other. And they, you know, they're not so bad. Actually, I kind of think the one over there, third from the rear, is kind of cute, right? And so it's Romeo and Juliet is what began. Bands and clans formed into tribes. Tribes formed into confederations. Confederations conformed into larger and larger entities to where you get empires, nation states. And ultimately, where does this process go? We think globalization, right? That we no longer live in a planet governed by individual nation states, but we now live in a globalized planet. But at the beginning, they were killer apes. They were really worse. They saw others as the enemy, and gradually they too had, like the wolves did, they had to shorten their flight distance. There they are. Oh, run right now. Okay, let's see where this goes. Let's just maybe offer them some food or something, or maybe put a spear down and back away from it, see if they want to take it. And so, before you know, so shortening that flight distance, making friends, intermarriage. That's pretty much happened. That's at the heart of self-domestication, both for wolves and for humans. As I say, that capacity to suppress the adrenaline circuits gradually produced larger and larger communities. And here in the 21st century, we're talking about globalization. But I want to roll back the time to some 20,000 years before the emergence of civilization, about 32,000 years ago, 35,000 years ago. Cro-Magnons didn't have cities, but they had begun to gather in semi-permanent settlements and villages. As I said, it wasn't elegant, but they had trash dumps, and this is the key. Still happens to this day. I'll explain this picture later. For now, just, do you feel anything when you look at that picture? I do every time. But what I've got here at the bottom are useful resources, some of the best and most readable for non-specialist books on dog-human evolution. And at the very bottom, a PBS Nova documentary, silly title, Dogs and More Dogs. It is superb. The guiding spirit in the documentary is Raymond Coppinger. He's one of the leading dog experts on dog evolution. So, when you look at garbage dumps in Mexico, for example, in there, what happens is that you have dogs that would be feral. You wouldn't go up and pet them, but they're there, they're in the thing, and they develop, even they, you see the tolerance, the shortening of the flight distance between humans and the dogs. The idea of a garbage dump is not attractive cuisine for us. but it was food. And in these days, in these times, when you're, it's difficult for us to remember that every wolf starts out the day, am I going to eat or starve today? And this is not a question of, I really should cut down eating at McDonald's or something. It's a whole, it's got a more existential bite to it. So it was food. And for wolves, winning the game of life entailed eating. Those able to live in human proximity with the advantage of easy food thrown out there in the garbage, there they go. I don't know what the hell makes these guys do it, but they throw it out every day. And, wait till they walk away and then you can go over and grab it, free food. They got soft to a certain extent, but they also got fed. They're wild. Again, not every wolf did this. Their wild cousins stayed off there and, probably looked down on them. Maybe the guys are eating garbage, disgusting. But they lived, they survived, and they reproduced. Was it a successful adaptation strategy? It has been estimated that there are 1 billion dogs on the planet today. Not all of them are living in good condition, but many people deplore the fact that there are children in the world who live with much less food and medical care than my puppy dogs do, right? Than many of us do, lavish on our puppy dogs. But there are 1 billion dogs. Wolves everywhere on the planet are on the endangered species list. Seems like a good strategy, right? It really worked as far as what's going to secure your survival. So again, these dogs, these village dogs, had taken the first step towards self-domestication. The reward was that they got more food, and more food regularly than their wild and skittish comrades in the forest. Natural selection took over from there, right? Those who got better food, those who ate more often, reproduced disproportionately. Maybe just a little bit disproportionately, but over time that little bit makes a huge difference. Our focus is on self-domestication. It's probably an overstatement, but an increasing number of scientists are asserting that humans and wolves are the only living species, or the most prominent living species, that have self-domesticated to the extent that they have. I know, cats. And they are wonderful. And I have had a cat who was a soulmate. But there is no way with a cat that you sit there and stare into each other's eyes, huh? I mean, they're domesticated, you do, okay. They're domesticated, but somehow different. They have an independence. They never let you forget. I don't need you. That's the cat approach. And again, maybe the biases of a dog lover, but who has had cats? Many people will say cats are not domesticated in the same way. And to a certain extent, you can argue that they're self-domesticated because they had to agree to live around barns at first where there were lots of mice. There were antecedent conditions, again, for both wolves and humans that predisposed them to be capable of self-domestication. Both of us are pack animals. You hear this thing of, the cowboy out on the range by myself. That didn't happen back in the good old days. You were a member of a group. We's all a bunch of damn communists. Well, we were all community members. You understand what I'm saying? I'm being facetious here. But we were all this idea that Thomas Hobbes said, if the social contract is made up, the world was comprised of individuals who decided to come together and make a social contract and we'll give up some of our power in order for safety. No, such a group never existed. To be as a human being was to be a group member. And a group was something very tightly structured, very hierarchical, lots of laws, lots of rules. You break them, probably we're going to kill you on the spot. But equally lethal, we are going to banish you from the group. certain death. You can't live by yourself as a human being out there without high-tech stuff. I mean, back in the good old days of the 40,000 years ago. So, in a very real way, social groups based on hierarchy and rules were characteristic of both wolves and humans. Not all canines have that, you know. Wolves have it. African hunting dogs have it. Anybody seen David Attenborough's wonderful documentary series on Earth, where he gets a high-tech camera in a helicopter and just watches a wild dog hunt? It's very sophisticated. Yeah, it's going to kill the damn gazelle. I know that, but it's elegant to watch. It's just extraordinary. Who doesn't have it? Dingoes, foxes, coyotes—they'll hunt in packs as family members, but they don't form official packs like dogs, where there is an alpha male and alpha female. The only cats we know that do that, by the way, we're talking about wild cats now. Feral cats, no packs; they just hunt by themselves. They're out there by themselves. The only cats that have natural pack behavior, lions have their pride, and hyenas have a whole family where they hunt together. And so it's not that usual. Many, not all apes. An orangutan. I love orangutans, but they are solitary critters. Some animals are solitary. Most prey animals can't afford to be. So when you look at a wildebeest or a buffalo, right? They're just natural, or an elk. They're prey animals, and they just naturally cling to a herd. So what humans and wolves had is that they were both pack animals. You see the three tenors here. That's very, very natural to do that for wolves, to sing together, to bond together. And they are group animals, groups with a hierarchy. What happened? How are we doing? What happened with those village dogs as they came closer? As we started, bold first human said, I'm going to try this. Keep your spear ready, okay? I'm going to see. And you try to hand feed the village dog. He probably grabbed it and went back. But then the second time, I come up, and all of a sudden, you're hand feeding a dog. This is the beginning to incorporating the wolves into the village itself. And what happened when that magic took place is that the wolves went through a transition. The alpha wolf, the boss female, the boss male, got switched over to us, which is why we have such a strong emotional bond with this. If you watch wolf pack, if you're not initiated to what this looks like, when you see a pack of wolves with a kill, it looks like they're ready to kill each other. They're snapping and everything. But everybody gets fed and nobody gets hurt. It looks like very rough stuff, but it's kind of a crude prefiguring of table manners, what's going on there, to a certain extent. That's actually what's happening. Likewise, we have, you know, the boss, the guy who gets the food offered to him first, etc., etc. This idea of giving allegiance and kissing up, they call it kissing up to the alpha dogs, is what dogs, when they came and joined us, they kiss up to us. Your dog is always happy, unless you beat the dog, which you would never do. But your dog is, oh, you had a shitty day, let's say. It's just everybody hates you at work, but you come home, oh, there's my puppy dog. Your dog is just glad to see you. Maybe you had to stay away for a day or so. Your dog doesn't give a damn where you were. He'll be overly anxious to see you, but he doesn't want an explanation, or she doesn't want an explanation. So what's this? I don't count. No. I'm just glad to see you. This is why we have such a strong bond with our doggy friends. When wolves, again, this is how they accepted us, not just as members of the pack, but alpha members. And this incredible look that you get. I was given this. It's Science, the magazine Science. I don't subscribe to it. And I was given to it by somebody in a class at Fromm because I had inadvertently mentioned that I take hypertension medication. You know, as far as, you know, augmented humans, what keeps me alive is these. And she came the next week and said, I have a present for you. And she handed me the magazine and said, look at that picture for 10 minutes a day and you won't need hypertension medication. I haven't run that experiment. I mean, I don't, no, he was wrong. He had a stroke, sure enough. And but there is something in this. Just, it's just a photograph, right? It's a photograph that when I show this to people, they kind of melt. Oh, boy, isn't that just, it's just wonderful. And it's just a mutt. It's not, it's just an ordinary dog, but giving you that wonderful dog look, and the actual experience of that is something that really, really seduces us, is what many people say, that they have hijacked our emotions. We, of course, we love our children more, but the dogs, a close second, a really close second, right there. They are definitely part of the family. A dog, unlike most cats, and pointedly unlike a wolf, one of the advantages that we had, I've mentioned it, I believe, last time, we are unlike any other primate in that we have white eye sclera. What does that mean? It means I can go, and you know that I'm pointing over there. Dogs pick up on that. Wolves don't. You can point over there with your eyes till the cows come home. Just go, I'll come back later. Call me when you feel better, right? You're doing this weird thing with your eyes, and I don't want to be around. So, but dogs do. Dogs make eye contact. Wolves don't. Wolves are still apex predators. If you make eye contact with a wolf, I've met some wolves and some wolf dogs, which always made me nervous. I had this friend who had a wolf dog, and I always felt like, you know, Irv, you don't know which direction this guy is going to go off, and you see you have a young kid around him or something like that, something terrible could happen, and it could happen very fast. But if you make eye contact with a lion or tiger, I mean, basically, you don't, one of the things they tell you, if you're around animals like that, don't make eye contact. Oh, you're so pretty. And what a wolf does when you want to make the eye contact like this, what's going on in the wolf's mind is sort of like a scenario from the Robert De Niro scene. You looking at me? You looking at me? You must be looking at me. I'm the only. So, in other words, the wolf is reading that as a challenge. They do not like direct eye contact. Dogs, by contrast, not only tolerate direct, sustained gaze, they actually need it. A dog can get crazy if you don't give that kind of. They become psychologically deprived. A little bit more about self-domestication. It has always made people nervous. Domestication, damn it, is something we do to animals. And they will point out, and it's true, a wolf is something crafted, lean. I mean, they don't have all these different body types. They've got one body type. They are like a torpedo that cuts through the forest, and they're made for hunting in a pack. They have ears that stand up. They have tails that go down. When they get domesticated, their tails go up. Their ears get floppy. Their coat changes color. Height made reference to a geneticist, a Soviet geneticist who was banned to Siberia. Dmitry Belyaev was his name. And he worked with foxes and found that in 18 generations, you could take a fox and transform it to a dog, which was not the object of his experiment. Somebody said, listen, my little girl wants a pet fox. Can you tame them for us? Because foxes are nasty. They'll bite and they're full of adrenaline, right? He fed them regularly, reduced the anxiety. The adrenaline cycle is tied up with the melanin cycle, which controls coat color. Their ears got floppy. Their tails went up. They started to bark. Foxes don't bark. These barked. And they finally had them, and they brought it to the little girl, and I wanted a fox. This is a dog, right? That literally that much transformation happened in 18 generations. Now that's artificial selection. It happens slower with self-domestication generated by natural selection. But people have worried about that. Are we at time?
Yeah, your time's getting short for questions.
Damn it. It's church. I shouldn't talk that way. I'm so determined. Okay, basically what happens to dogs, they're sweet and they're dumb. Oh, they have lots of intuitive stuff about them, but they become slow. You look at that Bichon Frise, this could never survive in the outside. And people have worried, is self-domestication and civilization doing that to us? If you ever got a chance to read H.G. Wells' classic, The Time Machine, he goes 800,000 years into the future, and humanity has degenerated into two subhuman species, the Morlocks and the Eloi. Actually, we don't have to worry about that because we don't get dumb. We get different kinds of challenges with living in high-tech civilizations, with dealing with technology. And I want to say one final thing. Dogs and humans are now entering a whole different phase of their close relationship together. People have discovered that for folks who have been wounded veterans, they sometimes carry these dreadful traumas in them and they have seizures. You can pair them off with a dog that can tell when a seizure is coming on, will bark, and the guy can just sit down. Dogs have now been trained to smell. They've got this great olfactory. They can smell cancer. So, there's other forms of diagnosis, but they can also smell cancer. Dogs are ideal companions for old folks who have gotten into a depression, who have gotten Alzheimer's. They can all relate to puppies. Okay. Do you have any questions? This is a huge topic that I tried to squeeze into 40 seconds. 40 minutes felt like 40 seconds, yeah.
How do you account for the rise of classes in evolution? It seems to me that when we look at ancient Egyptians, we see brother and sister marriages, and it brings out recessives, but not all recessives are harmful. Some recessives might be the very thing that you want for the next stage of development.
Yes.
And in that case, we will have the pharaoh.
Yes.
And his family, and then the rest of the people.
The standard answer to that question is an important question. How come? Because those hunter-gatherer groups, absolutely rigorously democratic. If you were the guy who killed the buffalo, you downplay it, right? You say, actually, well, I pushed the spear into the end, but it was him and him over there that helped me, and we all got this thing. You don't go Trump, okay? It's a good way to get yourself killed or ostracized in a hunter-gatherer group. When social classes began was when a certain kind of knowledge of seasons, knowledge of agriculture, with the emergence of domesticated grains and its collateral emergence of civilization. That's when you had to have people to protect the field, soldiers. You had people who understood the climate changes and what have you, priests. And you had rulers. So generally it's taken that the rise of social classes was endemic to the rise of civilization. Now we're at a question point where we've got prophets like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren out there saying, listen, we need to tone down. Yes, it's a natural development. Adam Smith, saw the tendency toward monopolies, right? And he said, this will kill the spirit of capitalism because you won't have the fair competition that brings out better products at a lower price will be subverted by that. So it's a problem that's endemic to the rise of civilization. And all I can say, it sounds like I'm being Mary Poppins here, we're working on it because we realize it's a problem that will overturn the agenda, and it has in the past. That's what that sense of unfairness. We talked about that a little bit last time. That sense of basic unfairness can bring people to not to do things that will get them killed for sure, but at least they'll make their strike against the power. That's obviously, this could be a whole class on that. Excellent question.
You had pointed out in these pictures Jalada's living with the wolves, and you said that was sort of a toned monkey. Was it also a toned wolf?
I mean, yes, thank you. Yes, of course. This wolf is a predatory species, Those baby Jaladas are yummy in one sense, but for some reason, the wolves have realized that it's to their advantage to live collaboratively, to live symbiotically with the Jalada troop. This huge troop of Jaladas, you don't want to start a fight with that many Jaladas, and you look at the male Jalada, he's got these fangs and teeth. So you don't want to start a fight with them, and they obviously get a benefit from living among the Jaladas. What kind of benefit? It always comes down to food. The Jaladas will scare out animals that the wolves can eat for themselves. The wolves can scare up things, provide defense, provide alarm for the Jaladas. It hasn't been studied enough yet. This was discovered about 7 years ago, and the thing that just knocks me out is when the Jalada goes and picks up the baby wolf and puts it down, and mom's just serene. I mean, this was the wolf has just grabbed my baby.
So I gather from the basic relationship between evolving man and the wolf is that they were kind of helping each other, and that the wolf helped with hunting. That's what I've heard.
Yes, that's correct.
But lately, I just saw a show on, I think it was PBS or so, Martin Clunes is doing this thing on animals, and he went to Japan. And women who aren't having very many children are using their dogs as child substitutes,
yes,
and putting them in baby carriages and feeding,
yes,
them at the table. So it becomes sort of pathological.
It becomes pathological. It contributes to a major quiet crisis. I don't think I've ever spoken about it here. Demographic crash. Have you noticed that people aren't having babies? And Japan is a poster child. And I don't want to give this a bad rep, because Nazi Germany was also in a panic about this, and there are Nazi propaganda films with sweet little ducks. You know, these people should be raising children, not lavishing all their money and attention on them. But the same thing that happened, and in Turkey right now, Erdogan is encouraging people to get rid of the damn dogs and have babies. The same thing's happening in Iran, right? These very strict Muslim countries, and also the strict Catholic countries. How about Poland? How about Spain? Italy? These are places where the population is not at replacement, and we got to have more babies. So like in China, I'll tell you what, folks, here it is. You don't have to have the one-child rule anymore. You're free to have as many babies as you want. And the young Chinese folks are looking at them and say, actually, we're doing just fine, thanks. They like being something close to dinks. Are you familiar with the concept of a dink? Double income, no kids. They like that. It's a bizarre thing, but it threatens to crash our social security, not just the social, but basically we have things where you pay in, and the younger workers go out there, they pay into it, and that keeps folks like me, thank you very much, getting a social security check every month. If that population pyramid turns into something that's heavy at the top and small at the bottom, if you've got one worker supporting, I don't know, four retired people, it's going to crash.
Our time's up now, but okay. I just wanted to say one comment when you were talking about the packs and the allegiance to the alpha dog. I was comparing it to the primary elections going on right now.
Yeah, it is to a certain extent. Actually, I really recommend dogs and more dogs. Because it captures that sense of bonding. There's this wonderful thing. They go on the street. They're in New York City doing it. And this old guy with this really New York accent, he's sitting there. What do you think of this girl, dog? He says, what do I think? I would marry this dog if it were a woman. You could do it with just a sincerity. I would marry this dog if it was a woman. He's just so closely bonded to it. And maybe some of you have had that. I have, actually. I have was my best friend in the world.
Thank you so much, Bill. Hope you'll come back again next year.